This week's IT News podcast is brought to you by Slack. Stay tuned at the end of the podcast to hear about the future of work from Sheila Subramanian, co-founder of Future Forum and vice president at Slack.
Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of the IT News podcast. Our guest this week is Suncorp's Executive General Manager of Technology Infrastructure, Charles Pozzato. Suncorp set a target to exit owned and leased data centers by early 2024, with 90% of workloads destined for public cloud and the remaining 10% for a hybrid cloud environment. The cloud migration is already well progressed, but some of the next phases will involve use of the Azure VMware solution as well as Red Hat OpenShift on both Azure and AWS. We dig into these and other migration strategies in the podcast.
So I'm the Executive General Manager of Technology Infrastructure at Suncorp Group. My role spans across both the insurance and the banking sides of the business. And in terms of the actual scope, what I like to say is the data center to the database and everything in between, in terms of the technology elements that underpin really our engineered systems and supporting all of our business applications. But certainly a big part of that over the last several years has become more and more about our use of cloud, which I know we'll talk about in due course. I'm also responsible for all of our end user technology at Suncorp. So it's all the technology that Suncorp staff interface with day in, day out to serve our customers. So things like our endpoints, like laptops and the desktop fleet, as well as the collaboration technology that we use to support what's now a very changed workforce in terms of supporting a flexible and hybrid working environment. And so that's come a long way over the last little while, of course, as a result of the pandemic. And then also I'm responsible for the technology service management across the group. So whilst I don't have direct control over the business applications that insurance applications and banking applications teams build for our customers, I'm responsible for the service management of all of that technology.
Okay. And it sounds like you have some stretch into the application side of things through the end user computing aspect of your role.
Absolutely. So the way we're structured at Suncorp, my area has responsibility for all of that end user application space. So whilst we have a CIO in insurance and a CIO in banking, it's more about the delivery of business applications to our insurance and banking businesses, not the technology that supports our staff day to day. That all sits with me.
Does IT infrastructure have its own strategy that rolls up into like a broader group technology strategy, or how does it work?
The infrastructure team does have its own strategy, but the overall group technology strategy has a number of elements that are very common to us in what we do in infrastructure. So the technology strategy at group level talks about keeping the business safe and running, which my team is absolutely central to from a service management perspective, hosting of all of our business applications. So very core to that. My team's also responsible for implementation of all of our security controls across the group. So really that pillar is all about what infrastructure delivers. The second pillar is around architecting for the future, and our cloud strategy very heavily leans into that in the way we deliver software to the business and ultimately for our customers, unleashing digital data and automation. Again, huge overlap with what we're doing from a cloud perspective. And then the fourth one is around transforming our ways of working, which is how we operate across technology. And there's a lot happening in that space now with our momentum model, which we're in the process of transitioning to, which is really a large scale change in operating model in how we run technology. From an infrastructure perspective, like I said, the cloud has a very important role to play in supporting both the second and third pillar around architecting for the future and unleashing digital data and automation. But in my strategy, I go a little bit further in terms of what we talk about, in terms of how we think about our multi-cloud architecture, and then how we more and more moving towards infrastructure as code. And then I also have another element of the infrastructure strategy, which is a little bit different, which is really around the end user side of the business. So I talk about the importance of having a frictionless end user experience for our staff to be able to deliver great things for our customers.
Let's unpack a couple of things there. And I guess firstly, because we've mentioned cloud several times already, it makes sense to dive in there first. So you've recently presented at a Gartner event talking about Suncorp's shift from traditional data centers to multi-cloud environment. Do you want to share a little bit about that journey with us? And maybe, I don't know where's a good place to start, but maybe something a bit about the origins of that particular package of work.
Yeah, I'd love to. And we're certainly no stranger to adoption of cloud technology at Suncorp. We started our cloud journey in 2014. And although I wasn't in this role at the time, I was very much involved in what we did in the early days of our adoption of cloud technology. And I think it's fair to say we were absolutely a leader in financial services in terms of adopting cloud technology early when AWS was really the only ball game in town. We set a very ambitious target to migrate a couple of hundred applications to the cloud over a short period of time on the stage in reInvent in 2014. And we hit that in the early days of cloud. And through the last 8 years, we've been progressively adopting cloud technology to the point where right now we've got about 65% of our workloads operating in cloud environments. And, you know, there are a few things about this. We don't think about cloud as just a cost play. Certainly, there are elements where cloud can deliver great cost outcomes. But really, the reason for cloud for us is around the flexibility and the agility it gives us. The fact that it can scale infinitely up and down to support the current needs of the business. And ultimately, the way in technology, it allows us to improve the speed to market for solutions for our customers. And that's the big one for me. And the big one, I think, for right across technology that we've been able to really stand up behind to be able to drive great outcomes for our customers.
Was the initial intention always, and I don't know whether this has happened, but was the initial intention always to step away from operating some of your own data centers and own hardware infrastructure, for example, and move more to a cloud-based architecture? What was the initial strategy there and how has perhaps that evolved over the course of the years?
The initial strategy was very much around how we take advantage of a number of the things I just spoke about to be able to provide better technology solutions at a faster pace for our customers. Over the last few years, one of the shifts that I've certainly seen is, firstly, it's on a backdrop of being able to prove that we can operate in a cloud environment safely and securely. One of the big things that I think about with cloud is the amount of money that organizations like Microsoft and AWS can invest in their security posture is many, many times what the size of an organization like Suncorp can. And you get a lot of that out of the box when you deploy technology to the cloud. So firstly, we've seen that we've been able to operate environments very effectively in the cloud. And over time, it's become more and more mature and in some respects, I think, a commodity. And we're at a point now where there are hyperscalers in the market that can just do this more effectively and more efficiently than organizations like Suncorp. So the reasons for operating your owned and leased data centers have become less and less over time. And that's really why we landed on a position earlier this year where we've set a flag on the hill very clearly to say that by early 2024 at Suncorp, we will no longer have any owned or leased data centers. And we will be operating in the public cloud with a small number of workloads remaining in co-location facilities. To give you a bit of a feel for the mix, say 90% operating in public cloud environments, the likes of AWS, Microsoft Azure, a number of SaaS services that ultimately are hosted between Microsoft, AWS, Google, and other suppliers. We also have a number of critical workloads in Kyndryl's Z Cloud and P Cloud environments. And then there are a number of workloads, about 10% is the number, that sit in co-location facilities because they're the sort of things that you can't move to a public cloud environment.
And so the stuff that's going to sit in colo, is that on like a private cloud or hybrid cloud infrastructure? What's the infrastructure set up for that non-public cloud workload?
It's a hybrid cloud environment and it's sitting in co-location facilities in Sydney within very close proximity to the hyperscalers. So it's fully integrated to the workloads that we host in the public cloud. And it's the sort of things that, for example, our core lending platform that sits on the Oracle Exadata and Exalogic stack or our P-Series environment. Some of those workloads that just specifically can't sit on an x86 public cloud infrastructure.
So you mentioned there that you're about 65% in the cloud and you're working up to, I think it was 90%. So that remaining 25%, is this more challenging potential workloads to do the migration, knowing that, say, at the start of the program, for example, you mentioned you did a huge amount of workloads, hundreds of workloads in a short space of time, which is obviously an AWS strategy and program for a lot of customers. For the workloads that are remaining, are they any more challenging or is it just simply a matter of cadence and this is the way that the program has worked?
We certainly do have some more challenging workloads in that mix, but The vast majority of those are workloads that are sitting on virtual platforms, and Suncorp is heavily virtualized. We have been for several years, and we're taking advantage of technology that has come a very long way over the last few years to allow migrations. We're going to be using platforms like Microsoft's AVS platform in Azure, which is a VMware on Azure solution, VMC, which is a VMware on AWS solution. And that allows us to move workloads in such a way that the effort required to actually test in advance of a migration and even PBT after a migration is materially smaller than what it was in the past. We're moving non-production workloads and even production workloads up to the cloud using this technology, only dropping a couple of packets. And that just makes you really think differently about how rapidly you can perform migrations of VMware platforms or virtual machines up to the cloud. We're also using technologies like OpenShift, which we didn't get to at the start, but a very important part of our strategy, as well as our use of container platforms. Container platforms give us a number of things. Firstly, the ability to have clearly standardized environments that we can offer to developers that they can jumpstart building software in a platform, whether that's on any sort of container platform. They can jumpstart by having an image that is already integrated to the various different platforms we have at Suncorp and is operating in a highly optimized environment. And they don't have to think about the traditional build a server, request firewall burns, add storage, connect to a database. You know, all of that complexity is already taken care of for them. And at the same time, the OpenShift platform and where we're going with our migration currently towards ROSA, which is Red Hat OpenShift on AWS, and then not long after that, the Arrow platform, which is the Azure Red Hat OpenShift environment, it allows them to have a workload that may be deployed, a build deployed into, let's say, AWS on that platform. And by changing a single line of code, be able to then redeploy that application to the equivalent OpenShift platform on Microsoft Azure. Or similarly, if at some point in time we decided to move that workload to GCP, you know, there's an equivalent platform on GCP, or even to a co-location facility on an OpenShift platform there, by changing a single line of code, that's just really powerful. The flexibility that gives you when you think about the partners you're working with and how you deploy applications. It's just an incredible shift from the sort of traditional tie-in or lock-in to native services when migration efforts from one cloud provider to another or to a co-location facility are complex and days and months. You can do this in minutes.
So are these two separate stages we're talking about here? So for example, when you're talking about the migration of virtual machines over to the public cloud environments, for example, if I was to characterize it, it probably looks more like a lift and shift kind of migration, whereas where you're talking about OpenShift, are you talking more about the refactoring or redesign of some of these workloads to be more microservices container-based and therefore to operate differently?
Spot on there. So there are a number of workloads where it makes sense to simply lift and shift them up to the cloud. We're getting a number of benefits I touched on before just by operating these workloads in the cloud in already optimized environments. The OpenShift platform is exactly as you described. The benefits there are around being able to build microservices type architecture environments. And we have a number of those already that support digital platforms. An example being we have a next generation pricing engine that we recently built in OpenShift, and it's currently on-premise, but we'll be moving to the ROSA platform very shortly. And we also have a platform called PlaceOS on OpenShift, which is the brain of our new building at 80 Ann Street in Brisbane, our new headquarters for the Suncorp Group in Brisbane, which is a fantastic new building and controls 28 different technology patterns in this building. And the surrounding environmental elements of the building, the real estate provide traditionally all controlled by that PlaceOS brain. And all of that's sitting on OpenShift. So that's exactly right that there are a number of microservices architectures, environments that are destined for OpenShift in the cloud, whether it's Arrow or ROSA, that will go there. Also, when we think about new workloads being built in a cloud-first approach, being able to offer our developers a choice to be able to build in these environments that are already heavily optimized and scalable in cloud directly.
Just to go back to when we're talking about the 25% of workloads that are going to still be migrated to public cloud, and you mentioned that I don't know how many, but a good portion of these are virtual machine migrations. Is there a reason why they were left until this point in terms of if they're a lift and shift kind of migration model? Is there a reason why they weren't done earlier in the piece versus why they were done now? I'm just trying to understand the cadence.
Not a specific reason. So we actually started deploying virtual machines to Microsoft AVS platform about a year ago now. And we moved some of our legacy environments, taking up different offers that Microsoft provided around extending support for some of those environments to AVS. And we did that because it made sense for those specific workloads to move them up. But I do think the technology has evolved quite significantly from where it was several years ago. We've proven that that AVS platform, which on top of Azure is very, very new, and the VMware platform on top of AWS has been there for a little while now. But what we're adopting first is the AVS platform. We've taken advantage of that very quickly after it became available in the Australian zones. The other point I think I would just make around this and didn't get to before around the workloads that we currently have in the data center that we haven't moved. Some of them are more complex workloads. We've got our Genesys Contact Center platform that's currently hosted on-premise that is the contact center platform for about 10,000 agents across our insurance business and the bank. And that platform isn't something you just pick up and move to the cloud. You know, we're going to take advantage of the opportunity to move that into a SaaS evergreen platform in the cloud. And obviously there's some work to do around how we get that there. And that's one of the more challenging migrations. Another one that we've already done was around the migration to the Z Cloud and P Cloud platform. Those two environments host some of our most critical applications, like our transactional deposits platform, our core deposits platform, and our insurance policy platform. So we've already completed some of those bigger rocks. We've still got some to do, like Genesys. Our virtual desktop platform is another one. Some of our more critical banking and treasury systems are also still to be completed as part of this next program wave.
So you've mentioned a couple of different technology partners here, but it'd be useful to understand a little bit about the way that you interact with the partners as part of this program, but also, I guess, as well, to understand the internal team that's been working on this and how it's structured and how you've upskilled some of those people to enable the ongoing cloud migration.
Firstly, we partnered very early in the piece with AWS, and they really were the market leader for public cloud, and they've been that for a very long time. More recently, there have been other really good options that became available in Australia, and we ran a complex tender process and came to an outcome where our multi-cloud environment will largely be made up of Azure and AWS as our e-hyperscaler partners. And it's not to say we don't have workloads in other cloud providers. I mentioned Google before. Google have done some great work with us around a voice bot technology, which is natural language processing and understanding what our customers are saying and allows us to, for instance, perform identity and verification on incoming calls, saving our contact center agents a bunch of time and allowing our customers to get straight to the point of why they called us. Yeah, that's one example. So from a hyperscaler perspective, predominantly Microsoft and AWS and some other SaaS services around the edges. I mentioned before, we're using VMware and Red Hat OpenShift has some of the key platforms built on top of those hyperscalers. We've also got partners that are working with us on both the design and the build of, for instance, AVS. We used Avanade to do the work on the design and build of that platform in Azure. NTT have been doing work with us around migration of some of our more complex workloads. Importantly, though, all of these partners are complemented by the internal capability that we have within the architecture and engineering teams at Suncorp. We've got a fantastic team of engineers that have been working to both build new solutions for our customers in the cloud, as well as more recently perform more of the migrations of workloads up to the cloud. And we've had that for some time. We continue to recruit a broad spectrum of different skilled engineers to complement our team at Suncorp. And they're really the key part of this. Like, we made a very specific decision not to go and get a partner in to perform all the migrations for us, for instance. The Suncorp team are absolutely central to what we're doing here. And it's a very exciting place to work in technology over the next couple of years for exactly that reason.
One thing you mentioned at the top of the conversation and that was really highlighted was the front-end benefits of this long program of work, and that was around speed to market. Are you able to just give us a sense of when different parts of the organization are wanting to provision cloud resources for their projects? How are they handling it? Do they have their own cloud accounts and they're doing this all via self-service with guardrails that your team has set up? How does it work now in terms of when the different parts of the business want IT resources?
So one of the key benefits we got very early on in our cloud journey is we took infrastructure off the critical path of any project that was needing resources. And so development teams have their own AWS workspaces that they can self-service provision the various different components or native services within AWS or just virtual machines on EC2, whatever it may be, they can go in there and self-service revision those. And they have been able to do that for many, many years. And there is certainly value that my team adds around some of the more complex application workloads, and where my team working closely with the development teams to be able to provision those.
And one other area, I guess it's worth mentioning when you've got a large amount of cloud, is we see a lot of organizations, banks in particular, going down their sort of cost optimization and the FinOps route. Is that a functional growing domain within your area?
There is absolutely an important element when organizations think about cloud around cost. But this is also at the same time a reason why many organizations actually pull back from cloud. And if you don't have strong automation and practices in place in how you're managing your cloud environment, costs can actually turn from a potential benefit to a detractor. And we've learned a lot in this space over the years, and we absolutely take advantage of a number of different processes to make sure that our environment is optimized. Simple things like making sure that environments that aren't being used aren't running is kind of bread and butter of when you operate in a cloud that you need to get right. The automated right sizing of environments in the cloud so that you're only paying for what you need. There are a couple of the big ones that I think just have to be in place when you're operating in the cloud. Otherwise, you won't get the benefits that you should be around it. And then, of course, there is the managed services element of it. Our people, especially when you're operating in, for instance, the OpenShift environment, you don't need to think about that overhead around patching environments and the traditional sort of management of those environments, firmware updates and all that sort of thing. Like, all of that's done and taken care of by the cloud provider. So you get away from that sort of element of management and you can focus much more on the business value that the workloads are effectively delivering. Optimization of workloads has to be on your mind when you first start migrating workloads to the cloud. Otherwise, you won't get anywhere near the benefits of cloud that you would expect, certainly from a cost perspective.
Just a final question and something I kind of asked, well, I guess, is where to next? What excites you about the next 12 months?
I'm very focused on the flag on the hill that I talked about before. We have set a very clear ambition around where we want to be in terms of our technology environment by early 2024, and we're already well on the road to delivering that. But actually getting that done and being able to claim that we are now operating in public cloud environments with a small amount in colocation is something that I'm very, very passionate about and seeing through. I think more broadly, we are continuing to work cross technology around how we can accelerate the pace of delivery of solutions. And one of the things that the recent changes we've made at Suncorp in terms of better aligning business and technology and our new momentum operating model will really give us a path to be able to very regularly pivot so that business outcomes are delivered by technology in the most optimal way. And what I'm doing and what my team is doing is absolutely pivotal to that. So the timing is aligning to be able to really shift the dial on the solutions that we provide to our customers. And I couldn't be more proud of the whole technology team and how we've been able to line up to be able to do that. So that's really what the next 12 months looks like. From my perspective, I could talk about things like infrastructure as code and some of the more detailed ambitions that we have, but they're kind of elements that will just tick over in the background. For us, it's all about the customer and making sure that what the Suncorp team work on is the highest value for them.
Hi, I'm Nate Cochran, contributing editor for IT News. And with me is Sheila Subramanian, vice president at collaboration provider Slack and co-founder of Future Forum, a consortium that helps businesses digitally transform. Sheila, welcome to our IT News podcast. Future Forum's recent update found more Australians working either fully remote or hybrid compared to the global average, and slightly more Australians than the global average were very likely to change employers in the next 12 months. How has the pandemic transformed our attitudes to where, when, and how we work? And have the past few years made us more anxious?
What we saw in March 2020 was that organizations made bigger changes than they ever thought were possible in how people worked. But what we saw was that many simply did the lift and shift. They lifted traditional office-based practices and norms, and they shifted them into people's living rooms. And so Future Forum, a consortium backed by Slack, was founded in 2020 because we saw an opportunity to shift from retrofitting existing ways of working, fundamentally redesigning how employees worked. And what we saw quarter after quarter is that flexibility ranks second only behind compensation when it comes to determining job satisfaction. We survey over 10,000 workers globally, and what we have seen is that flexibility in when they work actually has a higher impact on their overall employee experience. 80% of employees wanted flexibility in location, but a whopping 94% wanted flexibility in their schedules. What it ultimately comes down to is that people want more choice in how they work. And ultimately, it's critical for leaders to shift the conversation from command and control and power to a conversation about leading with trust. The reason why this matters is that we're currently experiencing the Great Resignation. Over half of employees are open to looking for a new job in the next year.
Innovation is a major differentiator for many businesses. And a large part of that innovation can come from these serendipitous moments, these water cooler moments, or these moments where you collaborate with someone over a coffee machine in the office kitchen. How do you replicate that level of serendipity in the work environment when workers, especially if they're developers, are separated by time and distance?
So in order to redesign how we work, it's critical that we make two shifts. The first is being office first to digital first. And the second is going from being C-suite centric to people centric. Innovation and creativity is not spurred by location. Instead, what diversity of voices actually have a higher impact on creativity and innovation. So now's an opportunity for leaders to redesign just their general practices and how they meet or even how they brainstorm. Encourage leaders to embrace is a more asynchronous way called brain writing. A leader puts a prompt at the top of a Google Doc or a virtual whiteboard like Mural or Miro. And then team members can come together whenever they see fit to input their ideas. And once all of those ideas are inputted, the leader consolidates them, puts a plan forward, and calls a meeting to discuss or debate how they want to move forward. The creativity and innovation is not necessarily going to get spurred by everyone being together in the same room. A more inclusive and effective way is figuring out how to make sure that all voices are heard.
Now, there's a saying that vendors should drink their own champagne. So how does Slack bring this conversation to life?
Put together a framework called the 4D model. If a meeting is for discussion, debating, making a decision, or developing your employee, keep the meeting. But if it's a status update or a brainstorm, you can use your digital channels like Slack. But one way that we've used Slack is every Monday, my team gets together and we submit like what our top three priorities are for the week in our Slack channel. Another way that we is Slack huddles. So when we have core team work hours, where we were coming together to work synchronously, rather than calling a 30-minute meeting to make a simple decision, we could use a Slack huddle to discuss something and figure out the plan forward. Think about it as a 5-minute conversation rather than a 30-minute long, drawn-out debate or discussion. In addition, we've used Slack to embrace a more asynchronous way of working. And one way we do that is by using Slack clips. Slack clips is basically a recording of yourself talking about a specific topic or explaining the rationale behind your decision. And we oftentimes run our company all hands using Slack clips. That way, we can record ourselves asynchronously, post it in a channel. And again, asynchronously, people can catch up and give feedback. So rather than thinking about the tool as a way to just communicate in a synchronous fashion, we've built a lot of ways to collaborate, communicate, and work together asynchronously. So people have more choice in how they work.
Slack is best known for its messaging, but you also have something called a digital HQ. What is it and how does it support this new way of work?
Well, redesigning work involves moving from being office first to digital first. And Slack offers more than just messaging. We integrate all the tools that you use in a single place within Slack. But we also give an opportunity for people to communicate how they see fit. Even something as simple as emojis to show that you've approved a contract or a thumbs up to show that you are okay with the decision forward. And so to move digital first, it's no longer relying on being in the office or being physically located together to get work done, but actually collaborating and communicating with one another through your digital HQ to move your team forward.
How should people get started, restart, or continue on their flexible work journey?
Recently wrote a book just focused on that question called How the Future Works, and it was recently named as a Wall Street Journal bestseller. There are three steps that I encourage leaders to consider as they're figuring out what's next. The first is listen to your employees. What we're seeing from our research is that 2/3 of executives are actually not listening to their employees as they're determining their future of work pulse. Second is that you're not going to get this perfect right out of the gates. What worked for us a year ago no longer is as effective, and the principles that we're putting out today may not be as effective a year from now. So what we encourage leaders to do is experiment, experiment, experiment. Take that growth mindset, iterate. And last but not least, transparency is a critical part of being a leader. People who do not feel like their leaders are being transparent about their future of work policies are 4 times more likely to look for a new opportunity in the next year. Now, transparency is not more comfortable not knowing all the answers. Maybe saying, I don't know, we're figuring it out, or I need your help. But by leading with transparency, as well as with more candor, what we're seeing is that employees then feel like they have more of a voice when it comes to determining how they work.
Sheila Subramanian, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And that's the podcast for this week. We'll be back with an exciting new interview next week. Until then, you can catch all the latest headlines in Australian IT over at itnews.com.au.